ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, counter-terrorism police arrest seven teenagers after last week's stabbing at a Sydney church. Also, inflation comes down slightly, but it's still proving difficult to control. And searching for solutions as the nation grapples with the shocking rate of violence against women.
What my experience was when I was running those programs, the men quite quickly would start to hold each other to account and would in fact sometimes be horrified at the behaviour of others.
In Sydney, counter-terrorism police have raided several homes and arrested seven teenagers today as part of their investigation of the stabbing of an Assyrian Christian bishop at his church last week. The arrests come as a fierce debate continues between social media companies and politicians over the publication of video of the alleged terrorism attack online. The heads of Australian security agencies are warning such content threatens the safety of the public. And they're urging tech bosses to comply with the requests of authorities to take that offensive material down. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Since the alleged stabbing at a church in southwest Sydney just over a week ago, investigators have been looking into a number of people they believed were linked to the crime, which was declared an act of terrorism. Today, they decided they needed to act fast.
As part of our JCTT investigation into the alleged Wakeley stabbing, we identified links between the alleged offender and a network of associates and peers who we believe shared a similar violent extremist ideology. The JCTT has acted swiftly to disrupt these individuals, and the investigation remains ongoing.
400 personnel from the New South Wales Police and the Australian Federal Police raided 13 properties at 11:15 this morning. Chrissy Barrett is Deputy Commissioner at the AFP.
At this stage, seven people, all juveniles, have been arrested and a further five are assisting police with our inquiries.
Deputy Commissioner Barrett says at this stage, investigators have no evidence identifying specific targets, places or times that the group might have been planning to attack. As for who might have influenced the juveniles, police say they're still trying to figure that out.
Now, I know that some of this will be confusing and confronting for some Australians and parts of our community. Senior members of the AFP and our community liaison teams have today held discussions with faith communities who we value and respect. Our relationships are very important and we never take them for granted. I want to be very clear. We target criminality and not countries. We target radicalisation, not religion.
She emphasised that there are no current threats to public safety and there was no suggestion of any attack planned for Anzac Day. Police seized electronic devices during the raids and their investigations are continuing. This comes as the role of social media in fueling extremism is under intense scrutiny. Around the same time the raids were happening, the head of the Australian Federal Police, Rhys Kershaw, addressed the National Press Club, speaking of frustration with the way social media companies responded to last week's terrorist attack in Sydney.
Social media companies are refusing to snuff out the social combustion on their platforms. Instead of putting out the embers that start on their platforms, their indifference and defiance is pouring accelerant on the flames. And if we consider the disinformation and misinformation from two shocking incidents in Sydney this month, and how that social combustion was propagated throughout the world, we see the consequences of that indifference and defiance. Our respected leaders of faith tell us how the interpretation of religion is being purposely distorted on social media. Because of this, their communities and religious beliefs are tarnished and blamed for violent acts carried out by those who've been radicalised.
Commissioner Kershaw argued safety is also the responsibility of tech companies.
My door is open to all relevant tech CEOs and chairmen, including Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. I know we can find common ground because, put simply, tech is supposed to make our lives easier and safer and not the opposite. It seems counterintuitive that in a world of advancements that our safety is at risk.
Richard Buckland is a professor of cybersecurity at the University of New South Wales. He believes governments, police and tech companies need to work together to make social media platforms safe.
In the early days, the platforms were sort of neutral places where anyone could say anything and do anything with anyone. But now we're seeing not only is that being good for, used for good, it's also able to be used for bad, this sort of contagion, this sometimes called information warfare or influence campaigns or just spreads of hatred. I think tech companies do need to stand up and cooperate with this. Of course, they won't want to, because as soon as they get involved with the actual content rather than just providing the service, that opens a huge can of worms for them. But if they don't do it, who will?
And do you think tech companies now need to be thinking about how they're going to keep communities safe, what their role in community safety is?
Yes, 100%. They should be proactive or things will be forced on them. And it won't necessarily be good what's forced on them, because governments will want control if they see that there's a vacuum. They do need to think about it. They were doing a good job a while ago, and then we sort of had a big U-turn around the time Elon Musk took over X.
Cybersecurity expert Richard Buckland ending that report from Alexandra Humphreys. In the federal court this afternoon, lawyers for Elon Musk's social media site X told the judge the company will contest any further attempts by Australia's eSafety Commissioner to have it take down footage of the stabbing in that Sydney church last week. The court heard X hasn't complied with the terms of an injunction issued by the court on Monday, ordering it hide the footage behind a court-ordered notice. It was also told one of the stabbing victims, Bishop Marmari Emmanuel, thinks the video of the attack should be available online. The judge extended the injunction until May the 10th. The censorship of social media sites is a big issue in India at the moment too, especially with the world's biggest election underway there. Narendra Modi's government is cracking down on what platforms publish in a far tougher way than Australian authorities, and it seems even Elon Musk is obeying the orders. Kunal Mujumdar represents the global organisation, the Committee to Protect Journalists in India.
A lot of blocking happening in the online space. The government of India has amended the Information Technology Act and brought in specific rules which makes it mandatory for service providers like YouTube or X or Facebook to remove content on executive order. These are not judicial orders. Sometime back before Elon Musk took over X, Twitter had actually gone to court, tried to challenge this, but unfortunately, because of the change of ownership, nothing happened of it. So online censorship is a massive, massive thing growingly. In fact, just last quarter of 2023, the YouTube report shows, transparency report shows that India was number one in terms of the takedown request globally. So that's becoming growingly a big issue concern.
You said the Indian government is cracking down on the social media companies and what they publish by way of executive order rather than going through the courts as they do here.
Yes.
How do those executive orders work, and have they been successful? Have the social media companies like X been forced to comply?
Yes, the government of India went ahead and amended the information technology law and made it mandatory for platforms like X and YouTube and others to follow the executive order, primarily in exchange for immunity from any other, because as platforms, they have certain immunities they enjoy. So in order to maintain that immunity, they are now being forced to comply with government orders. In the last few months, we have actually seen X, surprisingly, even under Mr. Elon Musk, two statements twice. One was during the farmer protest, and again, another one recently at the onset of the election, when they did go ahead and comply with the government order, but they also issued a statement saying that they're doing this under protest.
If Elon Musk had refused to comply with that executive order, what would the penalty have been?
The immunity that they get under the Indian law as a third-party kind of platform, that would go away. So, for example, let's take an extreme case, child pornography. So if a child pornography content is posted on a YouTube or X, X and YouTube are not liable for them because they're a platform. So that immunity is being given to these platforms, I think, and that's the similar law, I guess, in other countries as well. So that's why X or any of these platforms, they are not held responsible for the content posted on their platforms. So the Indian government says that they will take away that immunity in case these platforms don't comply with each and every executive order that comes their way.
Elon Musk has been highly critical of Australian authorities in recent days. You said that he objected to that executive order. Has he had much to say about Narendra Modi?
The statements which were issued by X were not, of course, issued in his name. They were issued from X, in which they protested. They said that they are complying with the orders, but they're doing it under protestation because they do believe in freedom of expression. While he's making those statements, I don't know whether he's taking the same level of hardened position on the issue of freedom of expression as he's taking in Australia. His relationship with the government of India is excellent. And as I mentioned, that he's exploring at least two areas. One is space, and the other is EVs. And he's expected to be visiting the country soon. And Indian government is really trying to attract Tesla to open, because particularly for EVs, you know, electric vehicles. So that's another part of the whole game, you know, because of the business interest that Mr. Musk and Indian government has in terms of Musk moving probably his operations to India, or at least exploring India as a potential market for his EVs.
Kunal Mujumdar is the Indian representative on the Committee to Protect Journalists. The latest Bureau of Statistics figures show that while inflation is falling, it's not going down as fast as hoped. Annual inflation came in at 3.6% for the 12 months up to March, down from 4.1% in December. And as Nell Whitehead reports, the figures are dampening hopes of a rate cut in the next few months.
The Reserve Bank has already hiked the cash rate to its highest level in more than a decade in an effort to rein in inflation. The latest official figures show annual inflation came in at 3.6% for the year to March, down from 4.1% in December. Here's Treasurer Jim Chalmers.
Inflation has now almost halved since we were elected a couple of years ago. It is still too high. People are still under pressure. But we are making some progress.
But the fall was less than expected, and quarterly inflation actually rose for the first 3 months of this year, up to 1% from 0.6% in the December quarter. The Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor, says that risks delaying interest rate cuts.
Not only did inflation come in above expectations, but inflation is accelerating. And we see today that the risk to higher interest rates, or interest rates that are higher for longer, is very, very real.
Sulin Ong is chief economist at RBC Capital Markets, an investment bank. She says the final push to bring inflation back under control is proving the hardest.
It's definitely telling us that that last mile, getting inflation back into the Reserve Bank's 2 to 3% target range, is really quite challenging. Our takeaway from the first quarter inflation data is that it was stronger right across the board, particularly the key core measures of inflation and services inflation. And that's what the Reserve Bank is looking at most closely.
The latest figures show that services like education, healthcare and housing are among the biggest drivers of inflation, with prices still rising fast. Education fees rose at the fastest pace since 2012. In the March quarter. Rents recorded their biggest rise in 15 years, and insurance costs took their biggest jump in 23 years. Here's Sulin Ong again.
And all of that is pointing to this ongoing stickiness in service sector inflation, and it's keeping overall inflation higher than is desirable. And so our worry really is that trying to get inflation down, particularly service sector inflation, is proving quite challenging.
She says a tight labour market isn't helping. Figures last week showed unemployment is still near historic lows. So what does that mean for interest rates, now at 4.35%? Sulin Ong says she's not expecting any rate cuts now until next year.
We're now only looking for two cuts in the first half of 2025. Previously, we had two cuts at the end of this year and two in 25. So we have both pushed back the start of some cuts and reduced the quantum. And that reflects, in our view, this somewhat firmer labour market than we thought, inflation that is proving elevated and a bit sticky against a global backdrop where we expect, for example, other central banks to be not cutting as much, including the Fed and the Bank of England.
And where does that leave Australia compared to other advanced economies?
We've been asking ourselves that as well. And I think the big difference in Australia is our starting point for cash rates at 4.35 is a lot lower than Canada, the US, you know, New Zealand, UK. So we've always been of the view that any easing in Australia would likely be later than in most of those central banks. It'd probably be a smaller amount because our starting point is lower. And so we maintain that. And we think that's even more the case now when we're getting signs of, you know, still elevated inflation and a fairly tight labour market.
The opposition argues today's figures highlight the need for spending restraint in the federal budget.
Neil Whitehead. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, the latest on Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York. In New South Wales, there are calls for urgent reform of the justice system after the alleged murder of a young woman in the town of Forbes in the state's central west this week. The New South Wales Premier has conceded the 28-year-old mother was failed by the justice system. Domestic violence workers say stricter conditions need to be placed on men on bail and more funding is needed for rehabilitation programs. Alison Shaw reports.
Already this year, 11 more women have died of gender-based violence compared to the same time last year. And today in Victoria, police revealed a 49-year-old woman has been found dead in Cobram on the Victoria-New South Wales border. A 39-year-old man who the woman knew has been arrested.
Over the course of this year, we have seen too many women already in 2024 lose their life. This has to stop.
Victorian Premier Jacinta Allan says everyone in the community has a role to play to stamp out violence towards women.
This is something we all have a responsibility to do. If we see disrespect being shown, we've got to call it out.
The calls for cultural change come as the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns admitted that 28-year-old mother Molly Ticehurst, who was found dead this week, was let down by the state's justice system.
I am saying right now that the system obviously failed Molly and the status quo is not going to work.
Molly Ticehurst's former husband, Daniel Billings, has been arrested and charged with her murder. The Magistrates Court heard he was on bail for several violent charges, including rape, intimidation and stalking. The state government has ordered a review of the state's bail laws and is seeking urgent advice from the Crown Advocate on what changes are needed. Barrister Geoffrey Watson says a review is pointless, arguing the answer is already obvious.
It's a need to monitor the men who are accused of these crimes. Now, some of them would be quite innocent, but you can't take that risk anymore. And what I'm talking about is devices which permit you to know where the person is at any particular point in time, ankle bracelets, or they are reporting obligations.
Mr. Watson, a director at the Centre for Public Integrity, says these powers are used in other cases, for instance, terror suspects.
And it will involve a curtailment of some of the liberties of some of the people who are the subject of these orders. But in light of the good that it could do for our community if we stop men killing women, then that's a small price to pay.
He says legal intervention is going to be more effective than continuing to drive conversations around changing male behaviour.
People have been talking about cultural changes of that kind since Adam and Eve. It's silly. That isn't working. That's been tried and it's failed. Now we need to experiment with other, perhaps more dramatic attempts at stopping this serious problem.
But domestic violence advocates say more funding for rehabilitation programs is urgently needed. Elizabeth Shaw is CEO of Relationships Australia New South Wales.
What we need is more investment. In New South Wales, we have 17 providers who are accredited to provide men's behaviour change programs. There'd be an awful lot of areas. Most areas don't have a local provider.
She says her organisation has nearly 250 men on their wait list to be part of the 18-week educational program.
They will wait between 3 and 5 months for a service, which I think all of your listeners would agree is an unacceptable position for a man who's self-professed as someone who's using violence.
A registered psychologist herself, Elizabeth Shaw has also been a facilitator of the program.
What my experience was when I was running those programs is that the men quite quickly would start to hold each other to account and would in fact sometimes be horrified at the behaviour of others and think, maybe I've got a chance to change this.
Patrick, who doesn't want to give his last name, enrolled in a men's behaviour change program a few years ago and says it was life-changing.
There was yelling and screaming. There was, wrestles over car keys because I wanted to go somewhere. So there was an element of physical. However, I wanted to be certain that if I ever was in a situation where I became aroused in an angry sort of way, that I had the tools to be able to deal with those emotions and act appropriately.
He says governments have a responsibility to increase funding for programs like these.
We hear about the absolute extremities of it with murders and the things that have occurred, but you have to, in order to try and address that, you can't go straight to that. You have to address it from the ground and work your way up. If the government is serious about reducing recidivity rates, reducing that level of violence, there needs to be programs that people can go to that want to change.
Victorian man Patrick, ending that report from Alison Shaw. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, please call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. An elderly sick man in Western Australia has had a big legal win, convincing a tribunal he was eligible to access the state's euthanasia scheme. Under WA's voluntary assisted dying laws, applicants must be what's called an ordinary resident of the state for the last year, but this man had mostly lived overseas for the last 15 years. As Kian Burke reports, the tribunal's decision could have implications for other states.
We can't name this man who's fought to access voluntary assisted dying in Western Australia, but his daughter wants you to know a bit about him. She sent a statement to the ABC.
Our father is a very strong, resilient, proud and fiercely independent man.
She also wants his story to help others struggling to access voluntary assisted dying or VAD. The 83-year-old man was diagnosed with laryngeal cancer, which obstructed his airway, leaving him unable to breathe, eat or drink without assistance.
He would endure a lot of suffering, both physically and mentally, if he was unable to end his life on his terms.
On medical grounds, he met the scheme's criteria, but the question of residency was more challenging because applicants must have been an ordinary WA resident for the previous 12 months, and this man had spent much of the last 15 years living in Bali. At the State Administrative Tribunal last month, he argued Perth was his home, and Judge Henry Jackson agreed. In his ruling, Judge Jackson said the man maintained a connection, returning for birthdays and appointments.
I place considerable weight on the evidence that he does not appear to have called Bali home when returning to it, but called Perth home when returning here.
More than 400 West Australians have been approved for VAD since it was legalised in 2021. A few rare but recent cases have questioned the ordinary resident requirement. Aidan Ricciardo is a medical law lecturer at the University of Western Australia.
This requirement was really designed to prevent people from coming to Western Australia, purely for the purpose of accessing voluntary assisted dying. Now, these people really can't be described as people who have come to Western Australia purely to access voluntary assisted dying. These people are people who've had long, enduring relationships to Western Australia.
He says the decision's unlikely to see a significant rise in those approved for VAD, but with it now legal in all states, he believes it could have an impact elsewhere.
Given that the law is relatively uniform across the jurisdictions, it's highly likely that the same interpretation will be applied in other jurisdictions.
WA Health Minister Amber Jade Sanderson has described the tribunal's decision as a sensible interpretation. Steve Walker agrees. He's the president of Dying with Dignity WA. He's urging the government to reconsider criteria that excludes people with dementia and other similar conditions.
How to deal with that is not simple, it's not easy, but we want to have it discussed during the review.
Minister Sanderson has previously said the laws are about personal autonomy and decision-making, which can't be exercised by a person with dementia, and better care is the answer.
Kian Burke reporting. And if you or anyone you know needs help, please call Lifeline. The number is 13 11 14. In New York, Donald Trump's criminal trial has heard a veteran tabloid publisher paid people to bury negative stories that may have damaged the Republicans' 2016 presidential campaign. Mr. Trump is facing 34 charges of falsifying business records in this so-called hush money case. And as Rachel Hayter reports, he's now also accused of repeatedly violating a gag order imposed by the judge.
The plan was to catch and kill damaging stories about then-businessman and reality TV star Donald J. Trump as he campaigned for the White House in 2016.
Our movement is about replacing a failed and corrupt political establishment.
Running the operation was the so-called tabloid king David Pecker, who at the time was the publisher of the National Enquirer magazine. David Smith is an associate professor at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
Former ally of his, David Pecker, detailed in great depth how Trump and him discussed what prosecutors have called a conspiracy to help Trump in the election by killing stories that were negative to Trump.
David Pecker told the court he offered to be Mr. Trump's eyes and ears to suppress stories that might hurt his presidential chances, including an allegation by a doorman at Trump Tower claiming Mr. Trump had a love child. Mr. Pecker testified he paid nearly $50,000 Australian dollars for the rights to the story so that it wouldn't be published. He said the story turned out not to be true, but he took action because of the potential embarrassment it would cause Mr. Trump and his campaign.
They did favourable stories on Donald Trump and at Trump's urging.
Nick Ackerman is a New York attorney and a former assistant special Watergate prosecutor.
They did derogatory stories on some of his opponents, including that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination, as crazy as that all sounds.
In this so-called hush money trial, Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records while attempting to hide his efforts to illegally influence the 2016 election. David Smith explains what the prosecution is alleging.
What makes this serious is that the prosecution is saying this crime of falsifying business records, which is usually a misdemeanor crime, that is, it wouldn't carry a prison sentence, was elevated to a higher level, was elevated to a felony crime because it was done in commission of another crime, which was an illegal campaign contribution. They're saying because of the fact that this hush money payment was materially contributing to Trump's campaign by keeping damaging information out of the 2016 election, that means it was an illegal campaign contribution under federal law. So it was a state crime of falsifying business records, helping with a federal crime of violating election law. If that sounds complicated, it is. It's a legally untested argument. Nobody has ever attempted to link this state crime with that federal crime before. And Trump's lawyers are saying in response that there was nothing illegal about Trump trying to influence the 2016 election because he was a presidential candidate. As his lawyer Todd Blanche said, that's just democracy.
Prosecutors in this case have also argued the former president willfully violated a gag order, calling potential witnesses sleazebags. Associate Professor of Law at Georgetown University, Vita Johnson, argues that might hurt Donald Trump down the track.
In the event of a conviction, this judge is the judge that would have to sentence former President Trump. And if he doesn't believe the person who's been found guilty of the crime can follow directions and order, that's someone who's no longer a good candidate for probation. that's someone who a judge might think, you know, what's appropriate is jail time or prison time.
The judge has reserved his decision on the Republican presidential candidate's alleged violation of the gag order, but gave a stark warning to Mr. Trump's lawyer, telling him he's losing credibility.
Rachel Hayter, thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It must feel like a never-ending battle for Rupert Murdoch. His British newspaper group is continuing to face legal action more than a decade after the phone hacking scandal came to a head. Now he's settled with the actor Hugh Grant. Today, ABC Media Watch host Paul Barry on how Murdoch has paid out many millions to avoid trial. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.